Rocha to Moore, and it's off the woodwork!
I'd like to thank everyone for coming and being a part of our first ever podcast, Off the Woodwork. My name is Zach Rocha, director of Sidekick Soccer Academy. To my left, Jason Moore, director of Moore Soccer Academy. Where'd you get the name, Jason?
I think it was my last name.
Oh, simple. Yeah. Simple stuff. Okay.
That's what they told me.
Jason, the former number one pick in Major League Soccer in 1999. We are taping this the day before Germany plays USA in a pivotal World Cup group stage match. The U.S. needs to tie or hope that that Ghana does not beat the crap out of Portugal, or that Portugal doesn't beat the crap out of Ghana, or a win against the Germans. What is the likelihood of that scenario, the win against the Germans?
Well, I think we all know it's going to be probably the toughest game in our group. Nobody expected us to be as far as we were now, so anything's possible in soccer.
Now, your thoughts about the Americans so far?
I think they've... obviously, they got the results, and that's probably the biggest thing at the end of the day. You know, nobody really cares if you played the prettiest soccer, as long as you're getting the results, so getting the wins.
So let's go back to the Americans for a while. Let's talk about them. We've got Jurgen Klinsmann making a very controversial decision before the tournament. No Landon Donovan. If you are the manager, if you are Jurgen Klinsmann, do you bring Landon Donovan with you to Brazil?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I think, especially now with Jozy Altidore out, would be perfect time to insert somebody with him with experience, with speed. That could maybe drop in right behind Clint Dempsey. Maybe he plays up top or vice versa. So you can't go wrong having somebody like him just on the trip in the locker room. But even now that they've had an injury, that was one of the biggest areas where we didn't have any, you know, depth, so to speak. So
now you talk about his experience, you talk about his goal scoring ability. He's 32 years old though, and you know, what would be a reason to not bring him? Why do you think Jurgen didn't bring him?
I mean, there's a lot of speculation, you know, but I mean this would have been his fourth World Cup, so I mean he has that proven track record. I mean, there's a lot of guys playing in the World Cup right now that are in that age bracket. With each team, really, you got the veteran players that are here. They're either playing or coming off the bench. But I think there was probably a little something that was going on behind the scenes with Klinsmann. And I really think what it came down to is Landon Donovan was very honest with him and said, listen, I might not be in the best shape. I might not, you know. Basically give you what you need at this point. And so instead of, you know, Klinsmann saying taking a risk with him bringing him, I think he kind of leaned in the direction of bringing some other younger talent.
Okay, here's my theory. Jurgen is a World Cup champion. Jurgen is the leader of the team from a managerial standpoint. Jurgen is the leader of these young men, and hey, this is how you prepare to win a World Cup. Landon never won a World Cup. Landon didn't show, you know, again, last year, that he was fully dedicated to soccer still, missed 3 months. Do you, like you said, do you want the locker room's leader, so to speak? Because you always look at your teammates, right? You and I, we're players. You always look at your teammates. Would you want Julian Green, the 18-year-old who just got called up right before, the German born on an Air Force Base player, which Jurgen seems to like, would you want Julian paying attention to you as Jurgen, or would you want him paying attention to Landon? I think that Jurgen said, I'd rather the guys look up to me and not even think about Landon. Again, this is my theory.
Yeah, I think it's exactly, I mean, it's kind of twofold. I think the one thing is, you're exactly right, Klinsmann's, he's won a World Cup, and he wants his team to look up to him, and if you bring in a Landon Donovan, he kind of prohibits him from having that sort of atmosphere in the environment in the locker room. So I really think that he wants guys that are going to be yes man, you know, and say yes coach, we'll do whatever you want, and look up to him and respect him. And I think Donovan was just kind of like, you know, with their two egos kind of going back and forth, he said, you know what, it's not I don't think I'll bring you.
And I guess we'll find out what's the right decision, you know, in
right a few
now
days. It's doing all right.
Yeah, and it's okay today. But, again, if the U.S. doesn't get through, you know, we'll look back on those 8 seconds against Portugal and really think about a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
So you, from a U.S. standpoint, you were in the national team pool. At the age of 14, you were on the U-17 USA team. You were on the U-19 team, the U-20 team, the U-21 team, the U-23 Olympic team. Very accomplished player. What have you seen in American soccer from when you played in the late 90s, you know, into the 2000s, into today in 2014? What's the difference? Why are we doing better, you know, as opposed to, you know, when you were coming through the ranks? What's changed?
I think first and foremost, the coaching has – the level of coaching's gotten better. You have a lot of the youth developmental programs, which you didn't have back then. You know, it was just kind of pretty straightforward. You played for your state team or regional team or national team and kind of work your way up. Maybe got some exposure playing high school soccer, but now there's so many, you know, kind of like our academies, you know, working with the kids kind of hands-on, bringing that experience, helping them, and kind of catering towards their needs. I don't think there was a lot of that back when I was playing. I think it was kind of either you had the talent, the raw talent, or you just kind of got left in the on the sideline, so to speak. So it's a lot better in the sense that if you're not just pure raw talent, these kids actually have an opportunity to make it and excel because of the coaching and because of coaches that care, really.
Now, I've heard you in other interviews say that you started playing when you were four. Just introduced to the game at that age.
Yeah.
I actually got a question before we went on the air today. Hey, is five too young? Is four too young? Obviously, I think you're an example that it's not too young. You know, I know that there are kids who play as young as two or three. You also didn't really seem to have it so much in your genetics. Like mom and dad weren't players or things like that. So, I mean, how did you find out and when did you find out at what age that, you know, you're a little bit special, like you're a little bit better than everybody else?
Well, I mean, I say I started playing at four. My dad probably just rolled the soccer ball out in the backyard and said, hey, go kick it, you know, against a tree or something, you know. Being from down south, we had trees everywhere. So, but, you know, I think that it was one of those things where my parents kind of steered me in that direction, you know, my dad did. So without their support, you know, to be honest with you, maybe I would have went in another direction with another sport because I was pretty well-rounded with, as far as sports go. But I think soccer, probably around the age of, I'd say probably between 8 and 10 is when I started, I think my dad could kind of distinguish between other kids that are playing and then me, and then coaches were kind of giving him feedback. So it was just that transmission line of communication between the coaches and the parents that kind of made, you know, helped my dad, I think, make decisions along the way.
Okay. On that topic, you talk about you're an all-around athlete. I made my career off throw-ins, you know, which is the oddest way to make a soccer career, but that's what I made it off of. I was in a conference recently, and they spoke about, you know, in Barcelona, Barcelona's football club also owns Barcelona basketball club, or Barcelona handball, or Barcelona volleyball, and Barcelona hockey. Now, it's still called the football club, but they're able to keep their players playing multiple sports year-round with each other, and it develops them as athletes. And, you know, the person at the conference was speaking about, hey, why don't we start doing that stuff here in America? Again, we've seen, I think, futsal has been a really big push here in the last few years. You talked about, you know, the development of the coaching, you know, the coaches themselves developing so that we're now improving the players. Is it too far off from us looking at maybe the New England Revolution, for just using a local example, doing a revolution, hey, we have a basketball club, hey, we have a volleyball club? I mean, what is the likelihood of that? And is anyone really making that happen in this area and maybe nationally that you've heard of?
I have not heard of that. I don't see how that could go wrong with kids playing year-round, playing sports and staying active, but also building that camaraderie that you're talking about and keeping it within a certain organization. But I don't think it would start at the top. Personally, I don't think it would start with somebody like the Revolution. They got so many other things that they're focusing on with building the league and everything like that. So I think it would actually come from, you know, an academy of some sort starting something like that, or maybe even a club soccer team. But I don't really see that happening. an academy where you can kind of have those different, you know, verticals, so to speak, you know, those different areas that, say, you had, you know, basketball over here, and you had, but everybody's kind of connected, kind of like a YMCA type of approach, but at a higher level, you know, where everybody knows everybody, the kids are playing with each other, you know, whether it's from school or whatever the case may be, but they're getting that high-quality training.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a key component to really making the most of something like that and really seeing the kids benefit from it.
Now, looking back, team sport, right? You have to be individually gifted, but team sport. Looking back, you're 14 years old, and you get asked to play on the U-17 team. Were you the youngest player?
Yeah.
Okay. Why did they do that, do you think? Why? What was the purpose in getting you on that team at such a young age?
Well, leading into that, I actually played a lot of the teams I was on. I played up in age group. So from an experience level, I think that helped me with the physicality of the game, and kind of expedited my growth as a soccer player. But also, I think one of the reasons they did that is just you know, I was able to compete at that level. But at the same time, I think there's always going to be on those older teams, you know, the coaches are kind of looking at the generation, the younger players coming through, so they want to pick maybe the one or two players, just or three or four, like Klinsmann's doing over there right now, you know, that can hang with the big boys and kind of grow with them.
Yeah. How did you identify with your teammates at the time? Again, was there someone who was like, hey, Jason, you're going to be, you know, my little guy, I'm going to take care of you, I'm going to show you the ropes? Was there someone like that? Does any teammates stand out that we would know of or you know, stand out in your memory?
On that national team, I think if anybody's familiar with John Bush, he's one of the goalkeepers in the MLS. Is anybody familiar with him? Plays for San Jose.
Oh, that's the other side of the country.
We're going way back.
Other side of the country.
Back. No, but there's to answer your question, I mean, there was the support from the whole team. And we'd have roommates when we traveled. So, you know, having an older roommate that's 2 or 3 years older kind of takes you under his wing. But it was, from a maturity standpoint, that was probably the biggest challenge. You know, you're hanging out with these guys that are kind of like adults in some ways, and you're 14. So, and then you're traveling to these other countries. We played the CONCACAF qualifying tournament before we went, which led to Japan for the World Cup in Cuba. So that was a memorable moment for me, was getting off of the airplane in Cuba and seeing guys standing around with machine guns and dogs, okay? Because for the younger kids, it's a third world country, so they're not as fortunate as us, and so there's a lot higher security there. And but that was just kind of an eye-opener, being 14, kind of when you walk around the airports over here, you don't see that kind of stuff, you know? So a little bit shocked from that standpoint. And then the parents out there probably know Fidel Castro. It was his birthday when I was over there. So a little history on that. So, but, yeah, it was great traveling around, but then you're also exposed to a lot that you ordinarily wouldn't be, and you're taking work from when you're in school on the road with you. So it's a different lifestyle.
So right now we've got, 80,000 fans, you know, at each of these Brazilian, you know, games here for the World Cup. I think when you say exposure, you talk about maturity and seeing things that you otherwise wouldn't see. And again, I think when you and I teach drills to, you know, 4-year-olds all the way up to 24-year-olds, you're really teaching the same thing. The difference is the confidence in the person to do it at a very fast rate and to do it almost perfectly every time. So I think, you know, I get the question a lot, you know, what should I do for my kid? How should I make him better? Well, what we're teaching them, have him do it or have her do it at full speed. And if they do it at full speed, they'll naturally get better. And have them get exposed, like you said, if that opportunity comes to play in Cuba. Heck, if you're a Massachusetts kid, to play in California. You know, we just mentioned San Jose, the goalkeeper. No one has a clue who he is.
Yeah.
But they all know who Bobby Shuttleworth is, the Revolution keeper. So I think that's something that I would always say is, if you want to play in front of 80,000 fans, well, first play in front of 80 fans, then play in front of 800 fans, and I think that's how you came through, and that's what you've indicated. To that, tell us another story. What's the coolest experience you've had inside a big stadium, on a field, college, professional, high school, any level? What was the coolest experience?
I think the biggest crowd I ever played in front of was in Argentina. It was around 80,000. I was with the national team, with the U.S. national team, and I loved it over there just because of the beaches and stuff, probably what they're experiencing in Brazil right now. But, you know, it was the adrenaline that I had walking out into the stadium and seeing that many people from another country, you know, screaming, playing for your national team. But I did get subbed on, and I just remember running on Ortega. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember.
Really?
Okay. I'm young.
Ortega was kind of like the Messi of Argentina at the time. So if you have a chance, if you want to Google him, Ortega. So he was a big player for Argentina. And I remember running on the field when I got subbed in and just tackling him as hard as I could. And that was like the highlight of the game. So for me. But that was kind of a memorable moment just because of the crowd and how passionate the fans are there. That was one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then winning a championship with MLS.
That's right. So
DC United.
One of the reasons we're here tonight is for the movie Next Goal Wins. Next Goal Wins is a documentary about the American Samoa team, the national team, that lost historically 13 years ago, 31-0.
Australia?
To Australia, who was in the World Cup. They had a good showing against Netherlands, but again, not someone we'd think of as a world power in soccer. And if I was to do the math on 31 times 7 to equate it to football, you know, touchdowns, I couldn't even imagine. It's like a Tecmo Bowl game on the old NES with you know, Bo Jackson. I'm not that young. And within that, you know, you got to play for the coach who they sent over, Thomas Rongen, and that's who you won your MLS championship with. You and I have not seen the film yet, but what can we expect to see in Thomas Rongen? What did you learn as a player? You know, what was his personality?
I think you can expect to see a very upbeat type coach, very passionate about the game of soccer, but also cares for the players at the same time. And that's kind of how it was. A little bit intimidating when I came out of college early to play for him because of his style of coaching. And a lot of you guys out there are going to have – you probably have coaches now that maybe are, like, crazy like Zach, okay? Or you might have coaches that are a little bit more, like, quiet, but they – you know, the way that they communicate. Thomas Rongen was really a coach that – he was very direct, okay, about his style, but he would also encourage you when he could and kind of support you. So you'll see in the movie his personality and how that kind of carries over to these players that obviously have a hard time with getting results and but he'll kick you in the butt. So
so you enjoyed playing for him. Who would be some of your other, if not your favorite, coach that you learned from?
Actually, Bob Bradley was one of my coaches when I played for the Chicago Fire. Anybody know Michael Bradley that's playing for the U.S. national team right now? Okay, I see a couple of hands on that one. His dad was my coach, and interesting story on that. He would come out and kick the ball. You know, he's a lot younger than us, and he would come out and kick the ball around in Chicago when his dad was coaching. And if you would have told me at that time that he'd be playing in a World Cup against guys like Cristiano Ronaldo, I would have said, you're crazy. And, you know, he's just a little kid, kind of like some of you guys out there, just kicking around on the goal, and we were the professionals, and now he's gone on to make a big name for himself playing over in Italy, and his dad's done well with coaching as well.
Yeah, Bob is now in Norway, coaching in their first division, I believe.
I think he was in Egypt prior to that.
He was the Egyptian national team coach. Now, I mention all this because, again, you talk about the coaching improving here in America. He's the first ever American-born coach to coach at a top division in Europe, any country. Now, Norway, again, a quality league, but probably on par with MLS, you know, to be honest.
Yeah.
But that's a big step forward. You know, Bob Bradley is very much a pioneer. You know, the Egyptian national team, which had all the political uproar. I mean, they were playing in empty stadiums because you couldn't have fans in. It's really great to see the Americans doing well on a global stage. And we're looking at, you know, 3 days ago, the U.S. plays Portugal, which on a personal level, we're in, you know, North Dartmouth. So
a lot of Portuguese,
I have
right?
a lot of Portuguese backers behind me here. You know, personal level, I've always liked the Portuguese national team. But you had 25 million American fans watch that game. And that's the most watched in the history of soccer in this country. And we hosted the World Cup in 94. We hosted a World Cup final.
Yeah.
You know, so that's amazing to me. And I think this could be a turning point year for the World Cup and for soccer in this country. You know, do you have that sense as well?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. Yeah. This is the most exciting World Cup I've just been glued to the TV. I'm going to probably be a little bit depressed when it's over. I have to admit that. But
now,
three or four games a day, you know, it's a lot to take in.
Now, for you, it'll be over July 13th, you know, when the World Cup final ends, because you and I are soccer guys. For the average American, is it going to end with the U.S., or will they have been attracted to the sport itself that they're going to enjoy watching Germany or Argentina or Brazil or somebody make that run all the way? Are we fearful that the TV ratings will drop when the Americans are out?
Or, I'm sure it will a little bit.
But is it going to be still strong enough, more so than you've seen in the past?
Probably not, you know, because there's a lot of bandwagon fans that jump on and they're riding the wave right now, just like they do with the Red Sox and, you know, all these other teams. I'm one of those. So
you're off the Red Sox bandwagon right now?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Should I still be on it? I don't even know what's going on with it.
I don't think so. So if you were to play another sport, you mentioned it. I had someone ask a question earlier, one of my staff members. What would have been the other sport?
Probably baseball or basketball.
Okay. And why so?
Or actually, now looking back, it'd probably be a kicker in football.
Oh, okay.
Because I could have made probably a little bit more money. No, but it I started doing that late. I kicked in high school, mm-hmm. and just having the soccer technique, you know, kind of, it helps you out a lot just coming straight into it. But
farthest field goal?
A 60-yarder.
60?
No pads, though, in a practice.
Wow.
But my very first time in a game with pads, we lined up. It was probably like a 20-yard field goal. I was pretty close in. And I just beamed straight at the guy that hiked it, right? Because I'm used to shooting. Your coaches tell you to shoot low, right? So I think that mentality just... I think I tried to stay over the ball instead of go up.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. All right. Wow. Now, we here in Massachusetts, we know John Smith made a career doing that, you know, and he actually went right into soccer as the Patriots kicker for a while. And you mentioned making more money, you know, playing in the NFL as opposed to soccer at the time. Now we have Clint Dempsey in his prime, you know, getting bought out, and he's making $6.5 million to play for the Sounders per year. You've got Michael Bradley doing the same in Toronto. Jermaine Defoe, who was an English Premier League player for a very long time, is now making about that money with Toronto. Julio Cesar, the Brazilian keeper right now, making similar money. David Beckham has a team going in Miami. You have Atlanta has a team going in down in where you're from.
New York, what's the guy called?
New York City.
Villa, David Villa.
Right before the World Cup begins, you have David Villa signing. He scored a goal 2 days ago for Spain. Now, again, Spain, unfortunately, they're at the tail end, but still, you know, that's one of the best strikers in the world 5 years ago. And they're now looking at Frank Lampard, who was a Chelsea legend, if not the greatest player in Chelsea history, you could argue. The league's happening,
yeah.
You know, and it's happening in a big way.
Yeah.
Is it going to be the fifth major sport? I've heard the joke, another podcast, Men in Blazers, says soccer's been the sport of the future since 1972 here in America. Is the future now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, it's you look at the EPL over in Europe where the English play, and it's the best league in the world. But it's not because of the English players. It's because the best players from all over come play there. So they make that's what makes up that league. So you're looking at that. If you transfer that to the MLS, and you're looking at, it's not going to make us the best league having just American players. You want that, but you want a mix of some of these guys coming from Europe. And I think the more that you see that, the more that we're moving in that direction. And in terms of, like, other sports in America, I definitely see that happening sooner than the players, the quality of our play, where we're stacking up against, like, the big powerhouses. Mm-hmm. I see that further out.
Okay.
So,
all right. So we're still a ways
the
away.
Quality from, of soccer, yeah.
From making the semis, making a championship
confidently,
game.
Like, hey, the U.S. is going to be in that.
Yep.
The Final Four.
I mean, you even say that with the U.S. national team. We joke about it, but Jurgen Klinsmann has seven people from his country, you know, so to speak,
yeah.
Playing for us. And you know, you do need an international influx to improve. And I think going back to the original thought here with the coaching improving, that's the thing that you said was really improving. I feel like I'm one of the first generation of coaches who's learning in the Brazilian way or the Spanish way or from an international standpoint. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always been a select few coaches, but, you know, through the National Soccer Coaches Association of America, through the United States Soccer Federation, seems like we're not being as stubborn as we used to be. And that we're actually, hey, listen, kick and chase worked for a while because we had the best athletes. You could be reasonably well, but it caught up to you eventually. You know, the more skilled players would control the ball, build up play. The Americans are playing a fairly pretty style. Yeah. You know, against Ghana, Ghana still outplayed them, but U.S. put away their chances. And against Portugal, it was pretty even, you know, for the most part. So, I mean, if there's a particular style that you've always been a fan of, which one would it be? Would it be the Dutch? Would it be Brazilian? Would it be a combination?
Well, that's one of the things I've been following closely in this World Cup and why I think it makes it so exciting, this brand of soccer that you're seeing worldwide now with all the teams, is you – and the Spanish are the ones that really, you know, started that. And so now you have these other countries that are really kind of molding it to their style. So they're incorporating the Spanish style with, so say, for example, the Netherlands, you know, the way they're playing right now. It's very attacking, knocking the ball around. They used to be a lot more direct, like England. Even England knocks it around. So you're seeing these teams kind of, maybe they don't knock it around like a Brazil or Spain, but they knock it around. And before, you know, it was just that long ball, kick it over the top.
Now, how much of that had to do with the field size? Because I'm not sure if the average fan understands, you know, the Italian league has pretty narrow fields, you know, and they play kind of a slower pace game. Pretty game still, but slower pace. The English Premier League has massive fields, you know. The fields can actually be different sizes at the professional level, much like hockey rinks here in America. It's not like in basketball where it's a standard size. When you were coming through, it was basically all football stadiums, right? Was that the main reason that it was kick and chase? Because now you have these soccer-specific stadiums. I think it's 17 out of the 21 MLS teams have soccer. That's the number one sport in that stadium. You know, I think, again, before I finish the question, the Revolution, for example, our local team, is one of the last teams that is playing in a football stadium, and the field's a little bit more narrow. Mm-hmm. Is it just field size? I mean, how much is that playing into it?
I don't think it plays a lot. I think it's more mentality. Like the being open-minded and starting with the coaches and them, you know, translating that to the players and the players adapting to playing a different style. Because now if you see it, you're playing – and it does change things a little bit if you're playing on a smaller field. You know, it's – you can get away with maybe not as much skill out there, you know, I guess. You know, for example, the league underneath the MLS, Rochester Rhinos, who are affiliated with the Revolution – a lot of the fields that they play on in that league are a lot smaller. You know, Atlanta Silverbacks is a stadium down south.
And that's the USL for the Rhinos.
Exactly.
The NASL for the Silverbacks. You know, you and I coached a minor league team a few weeks ago. There's not really a structure there as well. But
those in general are smaller fields. I think they even play probably on some high school fields, you know. So, but I think the overall, like, style of play is getting to the point where if you're on a bigger small, you're still teaching the players, and the players are responding to want to pass the ball around and knock the ball around. There's going to be times where you need to go long, but like you said, the U.S., I think the biggest difference from 4 years ago at the World Cup with our team and now is that we're actually trying to pass the ball around a little bit.
Yeah.
Which we can, and we're not sitting back afraid of other teams. We're playing with that confidence, because we're keeping the ball.
I mean, an issue I think I've always seen in American soccer was if they got a lead, it was lucky. You know, they felt lucky, and protecting the lead was always an issue. And that's where the possession really comes in. If you can't possess the ball, it's very difficult to protect the lead. Because if you're just dumping it in and then waiting for that team to build it back up, the more chances you give to an opponent, you know, the less chance you have of keeping them at bay. So, like you said, possession soccer is huge.
Well, a lot of people are criticizing we were talking about Michael Bradley for losing the ball in the midfield. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the opposite of possession. But but that's, in my opinion, I don't think that he necessarily, it's his fault. I mean, you had four defenders marking one guy, and that's all another story. But, and Cristiano put in the best ball you could put in the only spot you could have put it in. So there's a little bit more going on there, but we'll save that for the next movie.
Yes. let's go back to 1999. I think this is a question a lot of people want to know about. You came out after your sophomore year at the University of Virginia to go number one in the MLS draft. Again, that's kind of like, you know, LeBron James coming out of high school early or something like that. That's the talent level you had, you possessed as a player. You know, take me back to that decision. Why make that decision? Was it the right decision? Was it the wrong decision? You know, just I think everyone would be interested to find out what you thought.
I know a couple of the guys had that question. So I went to the University of Virginia. That's where I ended up going. And, you know, when I originally went there, I kind of narrowed it down to UCLA and Virginia. And I visited a few other schools, UNC Chapel Hill, Clemson, South Carolina, the Gamecocks, and Duke University. So Virginia, back then, they were really kind of the dynasty team, so to speak. And I knew they had good academics. I knew they had really good school for that. So kind of get the best of both worlds in the soccer. And now, having said that, it was always my dream to play professional soccer from a young age, like a lot of you guys out there now. I didn't know it would happen that quickly, because it was after, you know, playing two seasons basically and in school for a year and a semester that came that time for that teams were looking and talking to my coach at Virginia, George Yelnovich. And, you know, he kind of pulled me aside and said, is this something you'd be interested in? And I said, well, you know, at that stage, it's kind of like you don't really know all the ins and outs of it. And when he started to explain a little bit more, you know, DC United's interested in you and you would go number one and you know, they're coming off championships. I started to wake up a little bit and say, oh, this could be a good opportunity. So shortly after that, you know, I made the decision to leave. And, you know, looking back, you know, I always knew that, you know, I was always told, you know, in my upbringing that school was more important than soccer, and you had to find that balance. So, you know, part of me says, oh, it'd be nice to have a degree from University of Virginia. But, and even when I was playing, it was like you take that risk leaving early if you get injured, you know, and you're not making a lot of money like these other sports, making millions of dollars. So even back then, the pay's nothing what it is today.
Was it six figures?
So it was, no.
Not even?
No, not
even. For the number one pick?
Right.
Wow.
I came out at the wrong time. Went into the wrong sport. A lot of things I did wrong, but that, I don't think I have any regrets with the school decision to leave or anything like that. I tell everybody it was an opportunity I couldn't pass up, because if I would have waited another year, maybe I would have gotten an injury. Maybe I wouldn't have been playing as well, and I would have came out further later in the draft and down the line. So, you know, life's full of those kind of opportunities, and sometimes you just have to make those quick decisions. So.
I mean, as athletes, you know, we have two deaths, is what I remember. You know, you get the death as an athlete, you know, and it's a realization you're never going to play again. You know, at the highest level, you're never going to get that feeling again, that adrenaline rush, that physical feeling. I went through that, you know, certainly not at the scale you did, but I went through that, and I think that really helps you in life, you know, and it's nice to be able to control your own destiny. And that's what you did. You controlled your own destiny. And I think that's the great teacher of sports, is that, you know, you were identified as a great soccer player. That was your career, and you were able to take it at a very young age, you know. And you can always get your education, you know, after the fact. You can always go into other things. But your body can only last for so long, right. You know. Larry Bird's still probably the best player in basketball in the world, right? But he can, you know, how often can he do it anymore? It's one of those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you indicated education is important, and it is. But, yeah, you only get a short shelf life as an athlete. We call, I mean, who we call ancient, Ryan Giggs, right? Played for Manchester United forever, just retired. What is he, 35 years old? That's far from ancient, you know, for the human life.
It's unheard of, yeah.
You know. So, anyway, I just wanted to touch base on that, and I think people were interested. I'm sure it's a question you've gotten probably more than most other questions. To change topics... talk about what you've done since retiring. You retired in 2003. What have you been doing? What's occupying your life these days?
Well, I have a little girl now. She's 10, but that didn't happen until further after my career. My girlfriend's actually here tonight. So, supporting me, which has been good. And when I stopped playing, it's one of those things where you kind of like to take a little time away, just to, because it is so demanding playing at that level and the long seasons and everything. And you're not a kid anymore, so you're not playing three games in one day and just kind of ready, raring to go. So a little bit different mentality, but, you know, after the retirement, you kind of get back into the mode of wanting to play again and seeing other people play, and then still watching, you know, I still have friends that play in the league now, so it's difficult to watch them play, you know. But, you know, it's good to see them succeed, and a lot of them are younger, so it's just a matter of time before they get to that age. But I've had some other, in terms of like from a lifestyle and job perspective, I that's one of the things, the drawbacks for me when I stopped playing soccer was I didn't have that education. So in the sense that I could just go out and get a job anywhere or in one field or the other. So I got into sales a little bit, and I had some sales jobs, and, we all have to pay the bills, so, and stayed always kind of in the back of my mind, said, I just want to stay connected to soccer, no matter if that's in some way, shape, or form. Could be helping out with the Bolt Soccer Club, you guys probably are aware of, or the Vikings, or the Aztecs, or NEFC.
Or the 500 other soccer clubs.
Exactly,
here in
exactly. So, you know, and I had that opportunity to do that and help out when I could. And then one thing led to another. And as I started watching the youth a little bit more closely and seeing where kind of U.S. soccer was going and some of these kids that we were talking about earlier that maybe get lost in the shuffle for whatever reason, many reasons. It could be financial. It could be just because they don't have the right coaches in front of them. And they just kind of fall through the cracks. So when I started to see that, you know, my daughter was playing town soccer, and that's when I came up with the idea with my academy, and I said, you know, maybe this is a time to do something and call it my own and bridge that gap, you know, with the club level and then the kids. There's so many kids in between that don't know if they want to play club. They don't know if they just want to play recreationally. So, and that's probably the majority. So I said, if my academy can come in and kind of help kids grow the game of soccer, then that'd be a win-win situation and do something I love. So so I started that up about the same time Zach started Sidekick Soccer Academy, coming up on 3 years. Mm. You might be a little bit further along, but two or three.
Yeah.
It's all the same.
It's all
right?
A blur.
And so, you know, I've been fortunate along the way to meet people like Zach, and both of us kind of our visions aligned up with what we're doing with our academies and what we really feel is important for us to relay to the and how we teach, our style of teaching for the kids, and that kind of brings us to where we are now, kind of partnering up on some events coming up.
Yep. Greatest joy from the game, if you can sum it up. I know that's a very loaded question, but what's the greatest joy you've gotten from the game, whether as a competitor, as a fan, as a player? I mean, what makes it so special to you in your life?
Well, I never really thought about that. It's there's a lot of different moving parts, I think, to that question, but I think at the end of the day, it's kind of made me who I am. You know, I know that's kind of cliche, but I think it's kind of molded me into kind of being in the spotlight a little bit and then kind of being removed from it. So I've kind of been able to be on both ends of the spectrum, so to speak. And it's kind of helped me say, you're not always going to be in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. And no matter who you are, and you have to learn kind of how to live life outside of soccer. So I think that's one of the biggest things that I would want to pass on to the kids is whether you go on to play soccer or do something else, you know, those life skills that you learn from being around other good families, good, you know, traveling on your tournaments, those are probably some of the most memorable moments was going on these tournaments and, you know, staying in your buddy's room and eating orange slices in between games and, you know, and and staying in the shade, you know, between games, and just those personal relationships that you build with not only the kids on your team but with your coaches, that'd probably be, to sum it up, that'd probably be the best.
You know, it's really like a family type atmosphere. You know, you're going into, you know, I don't want to use battle in a in a very literal term, but you're going into a battle and you need people on your side. And yeah, that comes from off the field connections. So that's a great answer. All right, let's go to some of the fan questions. Samantha Medeiros, 12 years old from Dartmouth, favorite country, Portugal. How many hours a week did you practice? Do you practice? I think you can answer that either as a coach, as a player. You know, what do you remember?
I remember playing. If I wasn't playing soccer, I was doing some kind of training. Whether that was working with a personal trainer, just working on fitness. Whether it was my dad dropping me off after school to an indoor facility to play with older kids and just run around. Or it could be playing with my club team during the week, two or three times a week. Or it could be playing, whatever the case may be. I either had a soccer ball at my foot, or I was physically active doing something else.
Okay. Next one. Something we've already answered, but we'll ask it anyway. Willie, 9 years old from Newton. Favorite country, USA. Another good choice. What college did you go to? And I want to follow that up because we already know it's Virginia. Tell us about playing. You played for a national championship against UCLA. Tell us about that game. Because I think, again, being a former player as a coach now, we always remember the championship games. I think if we're in this for the right reason, championship games happen because things align. A lot of luck, a lot of skill, a lot of the camaraderie you spoke about. But they're the games we remember. So what do you remember about that particular game?
I remember a few things. I remember that we lost. That was something I've been trying to forget, but it's, I mean, that is kind of the pinnacle. That's what we play for, all of us. You know, we play for those championship moments, and whether it's be college, high school, national team, whatever the case may be. So, you know, at that time, Ziggy Smith was the coach for UCLA. He's the coach for Seattle now, where Clint Dempsey plays. Anybody know Clint Dempsey?
Oh, good.
Okay, good. Oh, good. I was going to think we were in the wrong sport.
I was going to say all that American push just went right down.
Yeah.
We're good.
All right, good. We'll move forward then. So Ziggy Smith was actually at UCLA when I was looking around for colleges, and I went on an official recruiting visit to UCLA, and he was trying to recruit me in. And then when I played for the Galaxy for a little bit right before David Beckham got there. I think we actually went to Portugal.
Great country. Lovely country.
Yeah, we can't talk enough about Portugal tonight. U.S. and Portugal all the way. But, you know, to take me back to that game, he was coaching. You know, he tried to recruit me, so it was very interesting, you know, seeing him and losing to him kind of inside going, you should have came here. But Matt Reese, the goalkeeper, everybody familiar with Matt Reese? Show of hands. With the Revolution?
Yep.
Well, he worked for my academy, okay, while he played for the Revolution. We played together when I played for the Revolution, and he is the goalie that I played against at Virginia in the national championship. So we knew each other even before we started our professional career, and if he was here, that'd be one of the first things he'd mention is the loss. So yeah, but playing, you know, that was probably one of the biggest games that I played in college, and it was great, you know, great atmosphere, and just one of the stepping stones that led me to...
Heartbreaking in the moment, I'm sure, but a life lesson learned, you know, because you then, a year or two later, you win a championship in Major League Soccer. Again, aside from in the moment where, you know, one's utter joy, one's utter sadness, you know, what are the life lessons you take from those two games?
I mean, the ups and downs?
Yeah.
That's one of the biggest challenges of being an athlete, and some of you don't have to be my age to know that. You know, you can be a kid and you 10 or 11 and know when you lose the game how that feels. You kind of, you know, you worked as hard as you could, but you didn't win the game, and you kind of walk off with your head down a little bit. But the sooner that you can get your head back up is a lesson to be learned there, you know, because if you want to pursue soccer and you want to be a professional, like in the World Cup, if they lose a game, but they got to look at the U.S. They lost to Portugal, now that Portugal again, and now they got to get back up for Germany. So, well, they didn't lose to Portugal, but they should have won that game. So, you know, that might have been a little bit devastating, even though they tied, but the way they tied. So that's just one example. But, you know, you have to have the right mentality, and that means you kind of ride the lows, but not for too long. You know, it's good to kind of go off and realize, and maybe I could have done this differently. It gives you something to work on. But then the next day that you train with your team or have a game, you want to make sure you're in the right state of mind and start focusing on that.
Two final questions, the most generic questions I can think. Ronaldo or Messi?
Messi.
Why?
Ronaldo before the tournament, Messi during the tournament right now. Because Messi, if anybody knows, is lighting it up.
He is?
Cristiano, I do not think was... I thought he was about 60 or 70% against the U.S. I don't think he was 100%.
But that's from a health standpoint.
Right.
Okay.
So that affected his play.
Yeah.
And like I said, if you're looking at current in their prime right now, you're looking at Messi. If you go back a little bit, then you could say Cristiano, but...
Well, when you say a little bit, you mean like before the tournament, just before?
Oh, yeah, before the tournament.
So you can go flip-flop nonstop with those guys, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, how's this? Who's going to have the better career at the end of it? And is it the best career of all time, or is there a player that still holds that mantle and will when they're done?
Well, they're saying they're comparing Messi to, you know, Pele and Maradona, depending on how well he does in this tournament. And right now, he's on track to... I think the only thing he's missing is a World Cup.
The championship.
Is the championship. Yeah. So, and Diego Maradona got that.
All by himself, basically, in 86.
So they're being lumped in, I mean, talk about pressure, they're being lumped in those categories. But the best players in the world, the Michael Jordans and the Messi, they rise to the occasion under that pressure, and he's scoring a goal every game. And the only reason Argentina is where they are right now is because of Messi.
Yep.
So he's carrying that team on his shoulders, and that's what you want to see. I'd say Neymar over Cristiano right now.
You are just upsetting the Portuguese
Masters. Because you know what? The game he played the other night.
I will give you a personal escort out of the movie theater.
I'm not up here to make friends, guys. No, but so that question could go. Like you said, it could flip-flop on any given day.
And I think you just said it, Neymar's now in the conversation. So it's an exciting time to be a fan. I think it's always an exciting time to be a fan. And here in America... You know, especially because apparently our national team's actually starting to get pretty damn good. All right, last one. Who will win this year's World Cup? Who will be the next power now that Spain has, you know, officially been unseated? We have to have a new winner.
Germany or Netherlands?
Which one? You have to pick one.
Germany.
Okay. Okay.
I'm German and Irish, but
And being left-footed has nothing to do with your Messi choice right now either, right?
No. Or Diego Merida. All right. Only the best players in the world are left-footed. That's where I was going.
Okay. I will work on my left.
I'm not saying I'm in that category.
I will work on my left. All right. I think that's going to wrap it up here for Off the Woodwork, our first premiere podcast. Next Goal Wins starts in about 5 minutes. We can't wait. Should be a great time. Want to thank our audience here at the North Dartmouth Cinemas, and we'll see you next time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.